I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. The March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom was held 100 years after the Emancipation Proclamation, 3 months after the Birmingham, Alabama police turned dogs and fire hoses on students protesting segregated public facilities, and 2 months after civil rights leader Medgar Evers was murdered. Speakers at the 1963 march had a list of demands: access to public accommodations, decent housing, adequate and integrated education, the right to vote, decent wages, and meaningful work. The historic march is being commemorated today on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, and among the speakers is President Obama. Well, today in Radio Times, how is Martin Luther King Jr.'s dream held up 50 years later? And we have three guests who have joined us. And joining us from Washington, D.C. is Eddie Glaude. He's the William S. Todd Professor of Religion and African-American Studies and Chair of the Center for African-American Studies at Princeton University. And Eddie Glaude, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It is my pleasure.
And also with us and here with us in our Philadelphia studio is Alexis Moore Bruton. She's the Associate Director of Communications and Media Relations Director at the American Friends Service Committee. I should add she's the daughter of Cecil B. Moore, a noted Philadelphia civil rights activist, lawyer, head of the NAACP here in Philadelphia, and also a member of City Council. And Alexis, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Also with us is Carmen Febos San Miguel. She's the Executive Director of Taller Puerto Riqueño, a community-based cultural organization. Primary purpose to preserve and develop and promote Puerto Rican arts and culture, Latino arts and culture. And Carmen, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me.
Alexis, if I could begin with you, because I know your dad was at the march, and I wonder what this day means for you.
I was too young to attend. We were children in the South because every summer our grandparents took the kids so that they got a break. My father was at the march, of course, as the head of the NAACP. He had gathered the resources, including bail money in case it was needed, to make sure that things went as planned. I wasn't quite sure what was happening, but I knew it was very important because there they were on television.
Did you see your dad?
I couldn't see him in all that mess of people, but it was really important to hear what the adults around us were saying, including my grandparents. Everybody knew it was something special, and I knew it was something special. Nobody was quite able to explain to me how it was going to affect us, but as one of the children of the movement's successes, I know now just how vital that moment was.
I want to pick up on that. Let me turn to you, Carmen, because I know you were a teenager in Puerto Rico at the time.
I was. 50 years ago, I was 15 years old, which actually then tells out my age.
Yes, it does. That's
what
okay.
Are we going to do?
Be proud.
Right. And, you know, the march and Martin Luther King and all of the civil rights movement that was happening in the United States, and because of the relationship that we have, Puerto Rico has with the United States, also was impacting our thinking. At the same time, it was a little bit distant to me, and I personally tell this story because, you know, I went to medical school in Puerto Rico, and the contacting poverty and, you know, maybe classism, etc., was very much part of everyday life, practicing medicine in Puerto Rico. And, you know, we used to go to health centers that served poor people in Puerto Rico. Coming to the United States made, you know, the word and the issues and the realities of racism so much more present. And it's not to say that there's no racism in Puerto Rico, but, you know, the type of objectivation of racism became much more real when I came to this country.
I want to pick up on that as well. And Eddie Glaude, let me get you in on the conversation. You might be the youngster in the crowd here. I don't even know if you were alive in 1963.
No, I wasn't. I grew up on the coast of Mississippi in a small town called Moss Point. And I remember coming of age, however, with an album, that dates me a bit, an album of the March on Washington. And I remember playing it over and over again. I had checked it out from the library, and I couldn't quite figure out the diction of A. Philip Randolph. But I was struck by the message of Dr. King, and I memorized the entire speech. And I remember delivering it to my history class with Miss Mitchell. And so it was a kind of beginning of a kind of political, coming into a certain kind of political consciousness. So the March on Washington, and particularly Dr. King's speech, and Mahalia Jackson's performance, right, continued to play a part in my memory of my childhood.
Well, let me just pick up on something, and actually we did a show about this yesterday, about the demand part of Martin Luther King's speech, not the dream part so much as the demand part. And it's interesting when you look at the demands coming from those who were organizing this effort, and I read some of them as an introduction to the program. And Eddie, if I can even go back to you, there were some serious demands being made by people outside of government to the government about how to address and redress the problem of racism and racial discrimination.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, when you look at the demand for the desegregation of all schools, mm-hmm. When you look at the demand for a national minimum wage, when you see a broadening of the Fair Labor Standards Act. Mm-hmm. So it's reaching across a number of different constituencies, and it's not just simply a kind of centrist politics, right? It's center left. In fact, it's left in its orientation. But we tend to remember the March on Washington as this symbolic and substantive representation of a coalition to end Jim Crow in the South and to speak to the evil of racial discrimination in the United States. But the vision and the expansive scope of the march's intent and reach is often buried in that kind of symbolic representation. So we have to be mindful of what I take to be the very radical politics behind this, right? Because this is an interesting coalition between labor, civil rights organizations, and other groups.
Well, let me go back to you, Alexis. Go ahead.
The American Friends Service Committee not only participated and supported the march, but we viewed it as integral to our work for peace. We are the preeminent peace organization in the United States. And as such, we viewed the march as integral to our work to end racism and poverty and militarism. I'm so glad to hear the professor point out the fact that there's a certain sanitization of that day, which is not true to history. Mm-hmm. People were making very concrete, very specific demands of their government. The group was not only a coalition, it was multiracial. Granted, it was mostly African Americans, but I have pictures back at our office at AFSC of Quakers and staffers, including Bayard Rustin, who people tend to forget, was an AFSC staff person, the key organizer of the march.
Right.
And the AFSC has always worked for peace, but work is the key part of that phrase.
Let me quote something that King said about nonviolent protests. He said, it rests on two pillars. One, resistance, continuous military resistance. Second, it projects goodwill against ill will. In this way, nonviolent resistance is a force against apathy in our own ranks. Just kind of underscoring what you were saying there, Alexis.
Absolutely. The speech's significance is buried often in the last words, which were beautiful. Let's not misunderstand that. But the real commitment to nonviolence as a means of changing the world resonates so much today, as Carmen and I were talking about earlier, especially when we all know that money spent on war is money not spent on poverty. Energy directed to militarism is energy directed away from human needs at home.
Go ahead, Carmen.
Well, in a way, like the professor was saying, the march, even to me in Puerto Rico, became sort of a stimulus to become conscientious or conscientized, if there's such a word, on the issues of race, which again, maybe the racism in Puerto Rico is more hidden, but seeing the extremes that were being practiced and how people were able to organize to overcome those situations and move an incredible powerful government like the government of the United States to recognize that became, you know, inspiring to me on a very personal level. And, you know, at Taller we do an event every year that is dedicated to Arturo Schoenberg. Arturo Schoenberg is a Puerto Rican of African descent who came to the United States when he was a young teenager. And the story, the legend says that when he was a child growing up in Puerto Rico, a teacher told him that Africans had no history. And, you know, according to the history, that motivated him to pursue a path of research and of uncovering that history. And he became part of the Harlem Renaissance and, you know, became the scholar that we know him to be. You know, and that has been an opportunity for us to really explore some of those dynamics of race that impact so significantly Latinos, who are this mixture of races, of, you know, white as well as African as well as indigenous.
Eddie, let me go back to you, and it's interesting to hear your three perspectives, but I wonder, even as we all look back on 1963 and commemorate 50 years of history there, what do you think the march accomplished?
Well, I mean, we have to understand the march in a number of different ways. One is that it was a massive demonstration of a general consensus that Jim Crow was evil and that the society should not be committed to de jure segregation. So the one thing that we have to acknowledge is that black and white people from all walks of American life, a quarter of a million of them, showed up on the Mall of Washington in front of the Lincoln Memorial and demonstrated a clear rejection of what you might describe in academic language, a Herrenvoke democracy, right? That this democracy is only for white people, right? So that's the first thing it did. It galvanized and crystallized, right, a set of demands and critiques of Jim Crow in the South, of racial apartheid in the South. It also did something really important, because it combined with this new medium called television. Right, it globalized the movement. It nationalized it. Right, it wasn't only now in the bowels of the South. It wasn't just in Alabama or Georgia or in Texas or in Arkansas, right, or in Mississippi. Right, it was now in the living rooms of everyone, and it also engaged the print media in a very distinctive way. And so, what we saw in some interesting ways is the kind of globalization of this extraordinary movement of freedom. And we know that it had an impact. I remember just not too long ago I was giving lectures in Beijing, China, and I'm talking to an English professor, and he was telling me how important the black freedom struggle was to him. And we're eating, and he decides to break out in We Shall Overcome. Right, and so what we see here is the kind of globalization of this moment. So it's interracial coalition and the globalization of the black freedom struggle, I think.
Well, we are talking about the March on Washington. Today marks the 50th anniversary of that march. Talking with Eddie Glaude, Alexis Moore Bruton, and Carmen Febo San Miguel. And taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
WHYY is a media sponsor for the Philadelphia Speaker Series, presented by Widener University, offering its 2013-14 season of diverse ideas, world perspectives, and thought-provoking conversation. 7 engaging evenings at the Kimmel Center, with a stellar lineup of speakers, including Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak, former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, poet laureate Billy Collins, and historian Doris Kearns Goodwin. Information at philadelphiaspeakerseries.org.
On the next Fresh Air, our late night week continues with Jimmy Kimmel. He loved late night TV so much as a kid that he founded a David Letterman Club. But before Kimmel made it to late night, he worked in radio.
So Jimmy Kimmel started in public radio.
That's right, and graduated to the public toilet.
Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Tonight at 7 on WHYY-FM.
The news doesn't stop between Morning Edition and All Things Considered. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson, co-hosts for Here and Now.
Your source for comprehensive news, information, and interviews in the middle of your day.
We're combining the resources of NPR and WBUR Boston to bring you stories that will keep you up to date.
Entertain you with features and music.
Join us, Here and Now.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. You probably know by now, today marks the 50th anniversary of the 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, our topic for today's Radio Times. This program note, WHYY, will bring you special coverage of events happening at the Lincoln Memorial starting at 1 o'clock this afternoon. Our guests are Eddie Glaude. He's the chair of the Center for African American Studies at Princeton University, joining us by telephone here in our Philadelphia studio. Is Carmen Febo San Miguel, a physician, also director of Taller Puerto Riqueño. Alexis Moore Bruton is the associate director of communications and media relations director at the American Friends Service Committee, AFSC. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Alexis, we can channel some of this history through you and your father, Cecil B. Moore. Philadelphia in the 1960s, I mean, you were a little girl at the time, but nonetheless, your dad was very involved in civil rights issues in this city. What was this city like at that time?
You have to remember that any movement that is challenging the status quo will endanger those who are even peripheral to it. As family, we were protected from a lot of that because, for one thing, in those times, girls were not exactly promoted to be activists, even though there were women in the movement who marched with my dad. But one of the aspects of this that I think people often forget is my father was part of that greatest generation, too. He was a World War II Marine, a Montford Point Marine at that. Then he stayed in the Corps for 9 years. At one point, a lot of his peers around the country also came to the conclusion that they had fought for the right to die for a country that would not give them what they had earned as American citizens. That mindset help them structure and plan and organize, because that's the other sort of sanitization that happens. People want to pretend this was sort of a spontaneous event. It was not. Movements are built on discipline and structure. And my dad and his cohorts here, some of whom have long left us along with him, made sure that there was a plan, that every demonstration, people showed up dressed, disciplined, prepared to go to jail. Here in Philadelphia, my dad led probably the longest continuous protest outside Girard College, which at the time was only for poor white male orphans. The school is right in the middle of North Philadelphia, which remains the biggest single population of African Americans in the city. So along with being quite legally questionable, yeah, this presence was a massive insult. And so for 7 months, my dad and the Cecil B. Moore Freedom Fighters, including Mel Dorn and Kenny Salam, I got to give a shout out, marched for days, literally 24 hours a day, around those walls. There was an interesting dynamic between the World War II vets, many of whom were also policemen, who treated each other with a certain respect. But it was still dangerous. It was still very frightening to many people because their association with black folks was generally not the best, which sadly remains today, as we know, those of us that get followed in elevators and at stores. The point is that, as the professor pointed out, this movement here was also a dangerous thing to do. It was also one of the reasons why my sisters and I grew up with taps on our telephones. What a waste. They weren't going to do business on the phone. But the point is that our movement here took place in front of bus stations and department stores, and it combined what they called selective patronage, led often by Reverend Leon Sullivan, another giant of the movement, to force the people who wanted our money but didn't want us to work there to let us work. We had a range of options that were determined in large part by those men's previous experiences at war.
Eddie Glaude, let me just quote something that John Lewis said at the time. He was a very young man, and he said, "Let us not forget that we are involved in a serious social revolution." And he talked about, he called on the marchers to find an alternative to a system, quote, "dominated by politicians who build their careers on immoral compromises and ally themselves with open forums of political, economic, and social exploitation." I mean, those are strong, dramatic, strong, powerful words that he spoke.
Absolutely. And we have to remember, John Lewis is coming out of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And these are young folks. These are young college students and high school students who are really, in my view, the engine of the civil rights movement, right? The sit-in movements that started in February of 1960 fundamentally transformed, in interesting sorts of ways, the black freedom struggle. And so part of what we hear in John Lewis's voice, right, is a reflection of the organizing work that's taking place on the ground in the bowels of the South. And I want to make this very clear.
Sure.
And that is, SNCC took issue with the March on Washington. They didn't quite think it was going to be productive. They thought it might take away from the actual work that was needed to be done in the South, organizing people. And so there was some conflict behind the scenes that we need to talk about, because it's really important in terms of how we remember these events. Because if we remember them in particular sorts of ways, we block from view some of the conflict, some of the contradictions that really help us understand our contemporary moment. So what you hear in John Lewis's voice, he was at the time the chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, right, is this kind of radicalization that's taking place as SNCC workers are organizing sharecroppers, are organizing in the face of unimaginable violence, trying in some ways not only just to register folks to vote, but also in order to cultivate an indigenous form of leadership where folk aren't just looking to Dr. King or SCLC or others to come in and swoop down and have a big speech, a big march, and then leave, right? And then the second point, really quickly, what we hear from Sister Alexis is that the movement was just not in the South. People tend to want to think that, you know, the march on Washington was just simply a reflection of racial apartheid in the Deep South. Well, no, we know that race and racial discrimination and racism has organized American life across geography for generations. And so when we hear recounts or stories of what took place in Philadelphia or what took place in New York, we know that the movement was up north and doing and out west, right, and in the Midwest doing amazing work on behalf of justice.
Let me turn to you, Carmen, because you have an interesting perspective in that you grew up in Puerto Rico, you went to medical school in Puerto Rico, you come to the States, you now work in Philadelphia, and your perspective on this whole issue is a unique one, I think, certainly for the four of us having this conversation here, because as you said, you saw classism, you saw poverty in Puerto Rico, but coming to the United States, you saw something else.
Yeah, and, you know, obviously, when I was 15 is a long time ago, and,
yes,
and some of these memories.
Okay.
More seriously, I mean, you know, Puerto Ricans have a difficult acceptance of seeing themselves as racists, and you know. When we, as Puerto Ricans, are confronted with the realities of such maybe more overt racism in the United States, and then look back, we realize in how many different ways our society is also very racist. So that moving to this country and that being confronted so vividly, you know, being an intern in medicine with a more objective or, you know, present form of racism became a much more eye-opener to me, you know, and maybe a stimulator of you know, maintaining this sense that we need to challenge ourselves on a constant basis if we are, you know, we all are going to deal and resolve some of the issues that remain and then we still need to work for.
And that's, I mean, it sounds like you're saying something both sort of personal and political, right?
Personal and political, yes. And through all races, I mean, we as, you know, as white, as Latinos, as African Americans, you know, as people from other races, etc.
Let me quickly reintroduce the three of you, and that's a Carmen Febo San Miguel, Executive Director of Taller Puerto Ricano, Alexis Moore Bruton. She is Media Relations Director for the American Friends Service Committee, AFSC, here in Philadelphia, both of them here in Philadelphia. And joining us by telephone, Eddie Glaud. He is the chair of the Center for African American Studies at Princeton University. And we are talking about the March on Washington, happened 50 years ago today. And coming up later on today, President Obama will be speaking at the commemoration in Washington. And we are also taking Eddie, that was a big exhale. I'm going to pick up on that, I promise. But let me just give out that phone number, and it's 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get to Josh from Conshohocken to join our conversation, then we'll pick up on that big exhale, Eddie. Go ahead, Josh. You're on the air.
Well, thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
I was so pleased to hear the guests discuss a little bit the Martin Luther King's message about nonviolence, and it just struck me that, you know, as even as President Obama is getting ready to give this, you know, speech on this anniversary of the march, he is probably at the same time literally thinking, what am I going to do about Syria, or literally, what military option am I going to take with Syria? And not so much to talk about Syria per se, but what about the legacy of nonviolence? It seems like that's the one piece of the dream that has gotten the least traction over the years. You know, is there anything left of that dream, and what's the relevance of Martin Luther King's message about nonviolence in an age where the question isn't so much what option do we take, but what military option do we take seems to so often be the question. And what does President Obama do, even as he thinks today, to honor Martin Luther King's message, to honor his legacy, knowing full well that he is going to... drop bombs.
Well, he could. I mean, certainly consider. Yeah, we don't know that yet, but we know it's certainly being considered. Josh, it's an interesting call, and obviously, Alexis, that's directed to you. Go ahead.
The American Friends Service Committee has been committed to nonviolence since its beginnings in 1917. Mm-hmm. We work around 35 cities and countries. We work for causes and with communities to help them heal. We are also working to change the narrative that seems to assume that violence is effective, when in fact there is empirical data that proves it is not. Nonviolence works on many levels in many places. For example, we have advocated for humane immigration reform since the beginning of the organization. We continue to oppose for-profit incarceration. And of course, we work for peace at home and abroad. We have never given up on what is at the roots of our community. We are a Quaker-based organization, and we believe there is that in all.
Go ahead, Carmen.
And maybe I would like to add, Marty, that, you know, Alexis and I, again, were commenting right before the show about in how many different ways the world has changed in the last 50 years and how many issues, you know, significantly the needle has shifted to improvement. And then there's so many ways in which the world is still dealing with the same formulas and the same solutions, and war is one of them. Mm. We are right now having a conversation about maybe invading Syria, and, you know, still our communities are so overburdened, and of course it is the colored communities that are even more overburdened by the violence that happens on a day-to-day basis, and how to combat that you put in, you know, more violence and put people in prison, and therefore, you know, Africans and, right. And Latinos are the largest representation in our prison system. You know, there is something wrong there.
Eddie Glaud, let me just toss something to you, actually, I'll give you a chance to respond to both what Alexis and Carmen were saying. And I said to them before we began the show, which is thinking about what President Obama is going to say this afternoon, that it's very different when 50 years ago you had civil rights people, not members of government, essentially going to Washington and issuing these demands. And today we have, you know, members of Congress, and we have the President of the United States speaking to the American people. It's a very different dynamic, it seems to me.
Right. I mean, it speaks volumes in a lot of ways, and that was the source of my exasperation. and one of the things that the great Bayard Rustin refused to compromise on was to have politicians speak at the March on Washington. He refused to allow politicians to speak. And that was for a reason, right? Because he didn't want the platform to be leveraged for selfish political aims, right? Even though there was this kind of larger political objective behind the organization and mobilization of folks. But we have to remember that the March on Washington was 20 years in the making. It comes out of the March on Washington movement with A. Philip Randolph, a labor organizer who was really trying to push President Roosevelt to desegregate the armed services in the face of the fascist threat. And there was going to be a massive act of civil disobedience in Washington, D.C. And, of course, then FDR signed the executive order. So this wasn't supposed to be some kind of sanitized, to use, again, Sister Alexis's words, kind of sanitized act of demonstration, right? It was supposed to be an act of civil disobedience meant to bring this kind of moral message to the fore. So here we are, fast forward 50 years later.
Right.
Now you have the President of the United States, in some ways, depending upon your politics, the leader of the free world, or the leader of the one superpower, or the American Empire, in some ways annexing, absorbing King's message. And this is the key that I wanted to, this is the point I wanted to make to Brother Josh. The invocation of nonviolence has always been, it seems to me, primarily invoked about black people, that they don't want us burning down buildings. They don't want us burning down cities. But the lesson of nonviolence has rarely been learned, that it wasn't just simply about African Americans becoming the suffering servant. But in some ways, there was supposed to be a transformation in the very people who were exacting the violence on black folk. So it was both and. Mm. It was a radical gesture. So the lesson of nonviolence, or the caricature of nonviolence, has been normalized, right? The caricature of nonviolence has been normalized in order to limit a certain conception of African-American politics. But the lesson of nonviolence, the miracle of nonviolence, has been marginalized, such that now you can have the President of the United States receiving a Nobel Peace Prize when he, right, lords over the most powerful war machine in the world. And now you have the President of the United States thinking about responding militarily to Syria, celebrating on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, not only the March on Washington, but the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. It's the stuff of fiction.
But are you saying he should not be there and speak even as the first African-American President of the United States?
Well, you know, I'm so tired of firsts. I think I would prefer him to be in the Oval Office or the well of the Congress pushing legislation that would be consistent with the demands of the march. One of the demands of the march was, in fact, to offer substantive and significant job training for folks, black folk and white folk and brown folk who were out of work. That seems relevant today. Another demand was a national minimum wage. Oh, that seems terribly relevant today. Another demand in 63 was to have the executive branch deal with housing discrimination. Oh, given the crisis in the foreclosure crisis, I think that's relevant today. So in other words, the symbolic stuff is important. I'd rather him engage in the substance.
And that's Eddie Glaude joining us along with Alexis Moore Bruton and Carmen Febo San Miguel. We are marking the 50th anniversary of the 63 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Call us. We'll be right back.
I'm Marco Werman. PRI's The World is news.
By this point, we've got more security forces just to keep people back for their own safety.
The world is changing.
There's a huge, huge number of young women veiled, but also wearing tight jeans and makeup.
The world is strange.
Posy Waller, which is a man inordinately fond of jam.
Join us on The World.
Tonight at 8 on WHYY.
Later today, special coverage from NPR and WBUR Boston, the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington.
And Dr. Martin Luther King's famous I Have a Dream speech.
I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. Join us for live coverage of all the day's proceedings.
That's an NPR and WBUR Boston news special, the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Daring to wake up from a dream. The March on Washington 50 years ago was a smart strategic tool to advance a certain set of legislation. 50 years later, we have to have new strategies. We live in a very different world.
The mission to make today's dreams real. New marching orders next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking about the legacy of the 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, talking about civil rights then and now. And our guests are Alexis Moore Bruton, Media Relations Director at the American Friends Service Committee. Her dad, Cecil B. Moore, a noted Philadelphia civil rights activist, headed up the local chapter of the NAACP. Carmen Fabo San Miguel, Executive Director of Taller Puertorriqueño, also here in Philadelphia, joining us by telephone. Eddie Glaude is the chair of the Center for African American Studies at Princeton University, and we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. What are you thinking about on this 50th anniversary? Let me get to Reverend Joe, looks like Williams or Willis, Williams, in on the conversation. Go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Good morning. Over 50 years ago, I met a great man who changed my life. As Cecil Moore, he not only got me a job, I became his driver. I'm an ex-Marine, he's a Marine, and then he got me a job at the corporate offices of Park Avenue of Pepsi-Cola. So he was fighting for jobs and freedom. I'm a witness that he sure helped me to get a job.
That's beautiful.
The order's there, and I was a pleasure driving him. He's one of the greatest men I ever met in my life.
Thank you so much, Reverend Joe. It's wonderful to hear from you.
Yes, sir, and they're going to make a movie out of his life soon, too, and be on the lookout for that. I heard some
from your lips to God's ears, as some of my Jewish friends say.
I think
say.
It would be a very good movie.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you so much for having this program.
Well, you're very welcome, and thank you so much for giving us a call.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. That's really one nice thing about doing a local show is you know, people know each other, and their paths have crossed in the past. I'd just be curious about your thoughts, Carmen, because both Eddie and Alexis is talking a bit about President Obama speaking this afternoon. I mean, what would you like him to say? Let me put it that way.
Well, you know, words are easy. I mean, I think that I have to echo what Professor Gold and Alexis are saying. And we need to see a lot more action than beautiful words. And in a way, you know, this has been said also by the other guests in your program, that we concentrate on you know, the passionate, beautiful images that the end of Martin Luther King's speech makes us feel, and it touches, you know, every core and every fiber. But the importance of the march is the action and activism that it generated. Mm-hmm. And those two things need to go hand in hand, because one is inspirational and fills us with, you know, passion and the need and the desire to action. But it is the action that produces the results, not the words and the inspiration.
I was reading something from the Pew Research Center comparing household wealth, finding that for white household wealth is 20 times the household wealth for African-American households and 18 times the wealth for Hispanics, Latinos, showing this. And perhaps even the recession and the implosion on Wall Street has really exacerbated this income divide. I'm looking at you, Alexis.
One of the reasons that we at the American Friends Service Committee are lobbying for a federal budget that meets human needs is because, as Dr. King said several years after the march, every bomb that explodes in Vietnam explodes on the streets here. This country needs an infrastructure that is rebuilt, because true security doesn't just mean weapons. It means an educated population. It means youth taken care of. It means health care. What the president, I would like to hear him say, is that he's going to present a budget that cuts the bloated Pentagon spending, that invests in the social safety net that millions of people, not just African Americans, and millions of people now need. They never thought they would. they're trying to find jobs. They're trying to feed their families. They're trying to keep a roof over their heads in the wake of the foreclosure crisis, or as the foreclosure crisis continues. We also would like to see this paid for by fair taxes on corporations. This is a country that is wealth beyond imagining. It is a matter of prioritizing where we put that wealth. Our national budget reflects our priorities. Right now, we seem to be like a household that invests in Uzis rather than puts food in the pantry for our children. We at AFSC.org have much more to say about this if you want to hear about our budget priorities.
That's wonderful.
Let me just go back to Pew. Something else, I'll toss this to you, Eddie Glaude, and then we'll get back to our callers here. This is Pew saying that the upper 7% of the population's wealth increased 28% during the first 2 years of the recovery. 93% of the population, that's most of us, saw a 4% drop. And I just wonder, you know, especially looking at some of the demands of 50 years ago and seeing some of the struggles, some of the progress, but nonetheless how this financial implosion has exposed these incredible disparities in this country.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, we talk about it as a great recession for the nation, but it was a great depression for Black America. When we look at, you know, between 2008 and 2010, 53% of African-American wealth just disappeared. During the Great Recession, we know that the majority of the financial advance that took place in the 1990s wiped out. We know that over 240,000 homes in Black America was lost. They calculate the loss, the financial loss within our community at billions of dollars. We know currently that one out of three African-American children are growing up in poverty. One out of five are growing up in extreme poverty. We know that African-American unemployment nationally is at 12.6%, and those numbers are cooked. Mm. Right? When we begin to drill down in it, we know that in some places you have 50% unemployment, particularly among African-American men. We know what's going on with the mass incarceration crisis, right? Sister Carmen already talked about the disproportionate incarceration of Black and brown men and women, and the impact that has had on communities. So, you know, we can talk about King and the March on Washington. We can engage in the Santa Clausification of King, as they did Nelson Mandela in South Africa. But we know what King dedicated his life to after 1963. We know what happened in 64. We know what the nation's response, or Alabama's response to 63, was the bombing of Birmingham, of the church in Birmingham, and the murder of those four little girls. But we know what happened in Freedom Summer of 64. We know what happened in 65. Selma is not this grand event, Marty. It's this moment in which the movement, the conflict within the movement came to the fore. Lowndes County, Alabama. Stokely Carmichael, just months later, announcing he's not going to jail anymore. What he wants is Black power. By the time King is murdered, assassinated in 68, he's organizing with garbage workers, trying to organize a poor people's campaign. None of this stuff has been resolved. Of course, we've moved forward, but there are people out here suffering. And I'm tired of this easy, facile politics of representation where people are excited because we got a Black man in a high place. Right. I would rather have substantive policies that are dealing with the least of these. So everyone go to AFSC.org.
You're getting some thumbs up here, Eddie
Glaude. I'm just tired of debate and switch. I'm tired of the politics of symbol. Mm-hmm. People are suffering, and it's dark out here, and we need folks to address that.
Do you see the kind of activism, I mean, and hard work, obviously, mm-hmm. that you just described there, Eddie Glaude, but I'm looking at you, Alexis, and also at you, Carmen, the kind of activism, I guess, that is required and patience and determination to affect changes. I'm also thinking about how impossible it seems to be to get anything through Congress these days, and maybe there are workarounds, I don't know, but I'm just curious about how you see the movement, or if there is the movement.
No, two things. Yes, there is. There always has been. People forget that African Americans have been walking towards freedom since we got here. We ran away in many ways. We did things with John Brown at Harper's Ferry, and in many other ways. We have always moved towards freedom. I would suggest that, among other things, what young people who are using the internet to do is not just watch videos. And they are doing things that are resulting in change. I would remind people of something called the Jena 6, when young men were threatened with losing their futures simply because they had a fight in a school cafeteria. Young black people organized around that, and thousands of people descended on that little town. There were young people Saturday at the march who are already committing acts of civil disobedience in their communities and who are doing it without worrying about whether people like me in my age group even know what they're up to. I would suggest that the front will change, the tactics may change, but the commitment to march towards freedom is not going away. That said, these young people who are being left behind have to be supported. As the professor pointed out, young people were at the core of the physical activism back 50 years ago. I would suggest they're still at the core of activism now.
Let me turn to you, Carmen. We had a guest on yesterday who talked about lessons that could be learned from the Latinos' leadership, having to do with things like immigration, even what could be learned from LGBT working for equal rights for gays and lesbians. As someone who obviously cares about this notion of integration, do you see some brightness on the horizon?
I guess, you know, similar to what is happening with race issues, is that yes, we see some things are moving forward, and at the same time, some things are, you know, either the same or the needle is switching to worsening. So you take the immigration issue, for example. Here we are, you know, in a country that where the population of Latinos is you know, equaling the population of African Americans, where there is very little representation, where the immigration laws are so disruptive to families and to individuals, and people that are born in this country because their parents came in illegally cannot get their rights. I mean, this is, you know, this is the so-called cradle of liberty. Where are we moving? So in some ways, some of the issues are so similar in terms of opening people's thinking to acceptance and to overcoming stereotypes.
Let me see what Dora from Pelton has to say. Dora, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
I was just sitting back and reflecting. I was a young 12-year-old during the time when the speech was given. But there's a person who participated in it who isn't given as much credit as he should, and that's A. Philip Randolph. Mm. The reason why I was specifically thinking of him was because my father was a Pullman, and I grew up in my young life in a family whose father was away a large portion of the time, 2 and 3 weeks at a time, because he was working on the railroad. And they experienced, you know, extreme forms of prejudice and all kinds of negative things. And as a result of that job, my father wound up being very quiet, ulcerated stomach. Wow. He would not bring that kind of tension back into the home. We grew up not knowing the kind of things that he experienced when he was on that railroad. And wow. A. Philip Randolph was the person who was standing up for those men.
Well, I appreciate your phone call, and you're absolutely right. We need to acknowledge A. Philip Randolph, and I guess from a daughter, two daughters talking about their dads. You want to add anything to that, Alexis?
The 10,000 men named George, as they called the Pullman porters, were the most organized, the most effective, and the most clear about what had to happen when World War II started. I give you props, and I know what it cost your family because I know what it cost ours. Thanks for calling.
Indeed.
Just really quickly, we need to just highlight the important role of labor in the March on Washington. We need to highlight it because we know that wages have been flatlined for over a decade. We know that there's been a systematic attack on unions in the private sector, and now there's a systematic attack on unions in the public sector, and it has depreciated deviated and destroyed in some ways the opportunity to the gateway or the pathway to the middle class for so many folks. So we need to accent the presence of a figure like A. Philip Randolph and Walter Reuther, because they help us understand in some ways the role of labor in the freedom struggle generally.
And we're almost out of time here, Eddie Glenn. I'm going to just toss a quick question to you, but an unfair
quick
thing
answer.
To do and a quick answer. But are you pessimistic about the future?
I'm not pessimistic, Marty. I just draw on what Du Bois said in Souls of Black Folk. He said it's a hope unhopeful but not hopeless.
Mm. Well, on that note, I'm digesting that. No, I appreciate that. Eddie Glenn, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And he's the William S. Todd Professor of Religion and African American Studies, also chair of the Center for African American Studies at Princeton University, joined us by telephone. He was down in Washington, D.C. Alexis Moore Bruton, thank you very much for joining us as well. And she's the Associate Director of Communications and Media Relations Director at the American Friends Service Committee. And she is also the father of Cecil B. Moore, a
daughter.
What did I say?
Father.
Oh.
That's okay.
Daughter. Her father was Cecil B. Moore, a noted Philadelphia civil rights activist. And Carbon Fabo Semiguel, thank you very much as well.
Thank you for having this.
You're welcome.
Incredible conversation.
Oh, thank you so much. And she's the executive director of Taller Puerto Ricano. Well, that's it for this first hour of Radio Times. And we do want to close things out with Marian Anderson singing the old spiritual, He's Got the Whole World in His Hands, performed at the 1963 March on Washington.
He's got the whole world in his hands. He's got the big round world in his hands. He's got the wide world in his hands. He's got the whole world in his hands. He's got the wind and the rain in his hands. He's got the moon and the stars. In his hands, he's got the wind and the rain. In his hands, he's got the whole world in his hands. He's got the little bits of baby. In his hands, he's got the little bits of baby. In his hands, he's got the little bits of baby. In his hands, he's got the whole world in his hands. He's got you and me, brother. In his hands, he's got you and me, sister. In his hands, he's got you and me, brother. In his hands, he's got